So we're on Chaf Hei Amud Beis. Hashem Aleichem Geshen, how are you? And we mentioned yesterday, if you weren't here yesterday, so clue in today, that the Rabbanan added to the Doraisa Psulim disqualifications for testimony. And on the list we had Roeh, which is a shepherd, and he's suspect of taking his animals into someone else's field to graze, and that's called Gzela. And a Gabbai Tzedakah, that sometimes the tax collectors, who were Jewish people, and they were appointed by the government, they got a commission, they got a salary, and they were suspect of sometimes pocketing some extra money. So let's say, for example, the tax was supposed to be 10, so they would add another couple of dollars, you know, and then they would pocket the difference. So we're up to today, Amar Rabbi Yehuda. So you're on Chaf Hei Amud Beis, you're counting up from the bottom of the Amud four lines. Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Stam Roeh. Stam is a word that's used whenever there's an absence of any knowledge, of any evidence. Roeh. We're talking about a shepherd. And we don't know for sure, we don't have ample evidence of witnesses that testify about this Roeh, that he has actually grazed into the, you know, with his flock, his animals, into someone else's field. But apparently this became almost a trademark of the shepherds. It was so rampant, and it was so commonplace, that even, according to Rabbi Yehuda, even a Stam Roeh, Stam meaning in the absence of any proof positive, the rule of thumb here with regard to Roeh is going to be guilty until proven innocent. Meaning that a Roeh is so often, you know, in this situation where he's tempted to you know, to let his animal, you know, it requires, you know, to make sure that your animal doesn't wander into someone else's field and cross the boundaries and eat from their grass, you really have to supply a tremendous amount of supervision. And the Roeh didn't bother with that supervision. You know, they would take their flocks up and down, wherever, in this direction and that. And inevitably, they would allow, you know, by virtue of non-action, if you will, and not supervising, not preventing the other, they would allow their animals to eat from other people's pastures. And that makes a Roeh into a possible Yedus, because he is in violation of Gzela, of stealing. And as we emphasized over and over again, someone who steals money from someone, for the love of money, he doesn't care about the prohibition that the Torah prohibits, Gzela, he may perjure himself in a court of law, and if somebody pays him off enough, he'll fabricate the truth, he'll falsify the truth. However, Stam Gabbai, in the case of a Gabbai, who is a tax collector appointed by the king, and he gets his salary from the king, they're kosher. In the case of Stam, where we have no explicit evidence, he is innocent until proven guilty. And here the Mefarshim, starting with the Rishonim and on, try to understand what's the difference really between a Roeh and a Gabbai. So there are basically two approaches here. One approach is that in the case of a Gabbai, he has to actively overtax a person in order to deliberately take that person's money and pocket it for himself. In the case of a Roeh, he doesn't really have to do much. As long as he takes his pasture, his animals, and he moves them from place to place, they naturally tend to wander into other people's fields. So in the case of a Roeh, he would have to actively do something to supervise, to chain in his animals, and prevent them from stealing. In the case of a gabbai, on the contrary, he doesn't have to do anything active to prevent stealing. He has to do something active to steal. And we don't assume that a gabbai, ipso facto, will necessarily do such a thing, and he'll take money and collect it. So that's one approach. The other approach is that there's a difference between something that is obvious, that is nikar, that is in a sense in the public eye, as opposed to something that's private. In the case of the roeh, it's really very, very easy for the roeh to allow, you know, his animals to go into other people's fields. It's not so obvious, you know, there's a border, but it's not apparent to everyone exactly where the borderline is. And therefore, the temptation to steal is so great because nobody really will know the difference. You know, a couple of blades of grass here and a couple of blades of grass there. It's not nikar, and therefore the temptation is overwhelming. However, in the case of a gabbai, this was in the public eye. It was very well known that the tax collector had to knock on your door, and he had to fulfill the quota that the malchus, that the kingship set up. X amount of money has to be collected from this city because of the population of that city. And it was pretty much accessible. It was not totally accessible, but it was accessible to most people to know exactly what the gabbai was meant to collect and how much he actually collected. In other words, it would seem strange in the eyes of a citizen if all of a sudden, you know, the taxes jumped, you know, and they changed from X to Y. Again, you have to consider that in those days, they didn't have, of course, the media that we have. So, you know, today, you know, you could probably, tell me, Don, if I'm right, you could probably go online and more or less figure out, if not, you have to get yourself a good roech hashbon, but to figure out exactly how much you have to pay in taxes. But theoretically, there are all ways to figure out what you're meant to pay. And in that sense, the gabbai tzedakah is under the surveillance of the eye of the citizen. For him to cheat and demand higher prices is a bit of a tricky business. So in most cases, the gabbai, even if he had a desire to overcharge you and take your money, he would be inhibited from doing so. So unless we have proof positive that this gabbai went ahead and he stole money by overcharging you and collecting a higher tax, we assume he's a kosher. But again, just to summarize what we call the bottom line here, please pay attention. Rabbi Yehuda says that stam roeh, that every roeh, until we know otherwise, is assumed to be what? Guilty or innocent? Guilty. And that's called stam roeh pasul. But if I'd ask you the same question about a gabbai, would a stam gabbai assumed to be guilty or innocent, what would be the answer? Innocent. He's kosher liedus until we have proof positive and testimony that he is a thief. So let me just read to you in the Hebrew some of what I already summarized for you in the English. It's always good to see Osios Machkimos. He says, Achiluk ben roeh legabai husha roeh olav lishmar esabehemos shalo yikonsu l'sod acherim. He has to go out of his way to exert an extra effort to make sure to surveillance that the animals don't spill over into Yenims, into somebody else's field. If he doesn't go out of his way with a special shmirah, on their own, they sort of wander into other fields. In other words, he doesn't have to necessarily go out of his way to send them into other fields. They naturally tend to move into other fields. And therefore, matzui hadavar, it's quite common, upaslu, and the rabbanon assumed that the roim were not going to make that extra effort to inhibit, to make sure that the animal doesn't go in. Aval gabbai, tzarech lasos maisa, he has to go out of his way to implement an action, litol yosim and aroilo, to take more than he has, than he's appropriate to collect. Lachain kolshin lo noda, if we don't have yediyah, we don't have knowledge, and not al yosim, that he took more, eno nifsal, he's not possible. So that's one approach. Then he quotes the Yad Ramah, who says the following: Achiluk, the difference between a ro and a gabai is that a gabai avodoso beyishuv bein ha-noshim. The gabai does his work in the urban centers. He's under the public scrutiny. Okay, he goes even a step further than I went. I said that some people might realize that he overcharged. He says, the people would rise up against such a tax collector, make a big scandal about it. He's pocketing money illegally. But in the case of a shepherd, malachto nases besados chutz liyishuv. Basically, the roe is out there in the mountains, you know, he's out there in the fields, he's away from the urban centers, and it's a cinch for him to allow his animals to eat in other people's fields. Lo yodu klal, nobody knows about it, that he's a thief, and therefore we have to assume that it's so simple for him to get away with it. There are no systems and balances, he's not inhibited, and therefore he'll fall prey to this, apparently, you know, this is the vice of that trade of being a shepherd. Now, in the next piece here, he has a question about the Braisa. The Braisa says that at some point in time, the Rabbanan added Gaboim to the list of those who are excluded from testimony. Yesh lahakshel. So let's ask the following question: Hare b'stam shelo yodua im lokach yosem imashen nixit lo eino nifsal. We just finished saying, according to Rabbi Yehuda, that as a general rule, unless we have evidence to prove that the gabai is overcharging and he's stealing, he's kosher. Now im lokach yoser, but if we do have evidence, and that's the only case in which we're going to disqualify the roa, Hareu Gazlan, then he's really a thief. He's literally putting his hand into your pocket and taking out your money. You're supposed to be paying 10 and he took 12. So therefore, Mais Chadish B'Gabai, why did the Rabbanon have to add this new category called Gabai amongst the Psuliedus? This man is an outright thief and we have evidence to prove so. So this is a real question on the Gemara. So if you take a look at the last Tosfos on our page, that's Divrei HaMashchil Stam. So with regard to Gaboim, Tosfos gives the following answer. He says, we know that this Gabai was taking more money than he should have. We have evidence. So the king asked him to bring 10, and he was charging 12. V'achidushu shegamim yachzir es mashalokach. The real chiddush is not that he's posuliyedus. For sure, he's posuliyedus. He's an outright gazlan, and we have proof to establish that. But the question is, can he do tshuva and reinstate himself as an aid kosher? And that's the principle called chazora. So what does he do? He has in his ledger, you know, a list of people from whom he collected these taxes, and he knows exactly from whom he stole. So he writes down, you know, today's date in his ledger, and he has a name of someone, we'll call him Yoshua, and he took from Yoshua an extra 2. And now he returns, he does tshuva, and he returns those 2 to Yoshua. He says, if he would be a gazlan in the classic sense, then that would be fine. And if the gazlan wants to reinstate himself as a kosher, all he has to do is return the gzela. But in this case of a gabai who's collecting misim, he's collecting taxes, it's not enough that he returns to the people there the money that he overcharged them. He says, because in the case of a classic gazlan, he knows exactly from whom he took and how much he took. Yadualo lemila hosh v'kamala hosh v'avol zeh. But in the case of a gabai, Tosis says he doesn't have it written down, you know, like an actuary, you know, like a not an actuary. What am I referring to? A bookkeeper. How do you say roe cheshbon? An accountant? What's
it? Accountant.
An accountant, right? A CP, right? CP in Canada, CPA in America. So he doesn't have it exactly written. So he doesn't know punct how much he has to return into whom. He's been collecting money and pocketing it for who knows how long. So his chazara is going to be much more complicated. He says, "Mikavon shadayin osuku begabos." Not only that, he does tshuva, but he didn't give up his job. He didn't resign. He still continues to be, hopefully, an upright tax collector, an honest tax collector. But you know what? As long as he's still involved in his original profession, we're always afraid that he's what?
Going to be tempted.
Correct, he's addicted to it. Do you remember when we discussed the case of Misachi Pekuvia? It's not enough for him to be chozer and stop from gambling and taking people's money, but he has to go even a step further and he has to desist from those games that he played, even if he wants to play them for free, like Monopoly and Risk. He's not allowed to do that. Or, for example, we spoke about the case of Malva Beribis. It's not enough that he desists from now on, he terminates his Halva Beribis. He's got to even desist from taking money from a guy. You know, a guy you're allowed to take ribis from. So here too, if he's still involved as a gabbai, he hasn't yet hung up his hat, so then even if he does tshuva, we're always afraid that he'll fall back into his old ways. And therefore, in the case of a gabbai tzedakah, the standards of tshuva, to be chozer and reinstate himself as a kosher eid, are very high and demanding standards. So for example, it's not enough that he repays those people that he thinks he remembers stealing from. He's going to have to build bridges, and he's going to have to make sure that the rabbim will benefit from it. Or for example, he has to give up his position as a gabbai, and therefore he's not tempted to go ahead and steal money. You know, he's created a whole thievery, a whole profession out of it. He's a professional gabbai in the negative sense of it. So he has to leave gabos completely. Which, by the way, for a person who gets his salary and he's been paid and this is his income for who knows how many years as a gabbai, that's a tremendous demand that we're asking him to give up his position and find himself another job. Fine. So again, just to summarize what we've learned until this point, there's a fundamental difference between a roe. Stam roe is possible, and we gave two explanations for that as to why the temptation on a roe is so intense, either because he doesn't want to put out his effort to go out of his way to make sure that the animals don't naturally graze in someone else's pasture, or because it's done in a way that nobody knows the difference, so that's very tempting. No one can catch him in his crime. A couple of blades of grass here and a couple of blades of grass there. Again, it all depends how much money you're paying for grass. Okay. Nobody got that. Anyway, so in the in the case of a gabbai, however, stam gabbai is kosher liedus until we know for sure that he's a gazlan, because in general a gabbai would be very inhibited about doing this because he's in the public eye, and also he has to go out of his way actively to steal. And then we ask the question: so why did the chacham have to add the case of a gabbai as a psul? If we have evidence that he's stealing, then he's an outright thief. And the answer is that the Rabbanan imposed upon him very strict measures as to the law of chazara. In other words, there's a natural psul of a gazlan that's a doraisa halacha that simply is a result of his gzela. But that he could fix up by simply fulfilling the mitzvah of Eishav Zagzelash or Gaza. But now in the case of a gabbai who's a gazlan, the Rabbanan imposed upon him another category of a psul. So in addition to being pasul on a doraisa level, he's pasul on a Rabbanan level. Now if I would ask you for a knee-jerk response, which is more chamor, a psul doraisa or a psul Rabbanan? What would you say?
Doraisa.
A doraisa, no. In this case, we have an exception to the rule. The psul d'rabbanan is more harsh and more severe than the psul d'oraisa. And the nafkamina is going to be chazara. If it's a psul d'oraisa of gazlan, all he has to do is return the gzela, and he's kosher. He reinstates himself as an eid kosher. But in the case of psul d'rabbanan, the rabbanan required, in order to reinstate yourself as an eid kosher, that you go to the other extreme. That not only do you return all the money that you stole, but that you desist from being, you give up your job and you resign as a gabbai. So that's what we have in the name of the Yad Ramah and in the name of the Or Zarua. Now, if you recall, earlier on this daf, we had a brisa of Hosifu Aleim Roim, Gaboim, and Mochsin. Now, Mochsin are also tax collectors, and yet the Rambam in Hilchas Eidus, Perik Yud Paskins, that Stam Mochsin, Pasul Eidus. And that's how it's codified in Shulchan Aruch, in Choshe Mishpat Simon Lamed Dalet Stam Moches Pasul. So now we have to rack our brains and try to figure out what's the difference between a Gabbai and a Moches. They both were added by the Rabbanan to this enumerated list of disqualified testimony. In the case of Gabbai, we established here, and it's codified in Shulchan Aruch, that Stam Gabbai is kosher. Why should a Stam Moches, according to the Rambam in Shulchan Aruch, be Pasul? What's the difference between a Moches and a Gabbai? So here I want to quote to the Beit Yosef, right? The Moran HaMechaber, who in his commentary on the tour, and he writes the following. What's the difference between a Gabbai and a Moches? The Moches actually shells money out of his pocket in order to get this minui, in order to get this appointment as a Moches. In the case of a Gabbai, he's paid by the Malchus to offer this service of collecting the taxes. That's the case of a Gabbai. What's a Moches? Kone me'amelech, zchus gvia. So the king says, look, you know what? The taxes for this particular city should reach 10,000. That's what I'm expecting. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to make you a deal. I'm going to charge you $5,000 and you can pocket the rest. Now again, it turns out that he's getting a salary of $5,000. You follow what I mean? Because he's going to collect $10,000 and he's going to pocket $5,000. But it's different than a Gabbai. A Gabbai delivers all the collected taxes directly to whom? To the Melech. In the case of a Moches, he pockets the money that he collects. And he's bought those rights, like, again, I don't know if this is American culture or this is international, like in the case of a taxi cab driver who buys a medallion. Does that ring a bell to other countries? Do they have that in Canada?
They take cabs in the betting system.
Do you have something called a medallion for in England, which means that there's a company that owns the rights to drive the cabs, and if you want to drive your cab, you have to buy those rights. So the Moches buys rights, but all the money that's coming in that he's collected is his money. You know, the government decided what it's worth it for them to pay. What they did was they offered him the rights to pocket the money if he'll deliver such and such an amount. Says the Beis Yosef, in the case of a Moches, Choshesh in Yosef, we have a real serious suspicion, Shegove Yosef in Aroi. Right, there's no way of clarifying, nobody could, there's no system of checks and balances that would inhibit him to up the ante and collect more money. So in the case of a Gabbai, he's just, you know, go online, you figure out what your taxes are, given your income, etc., etc. And we know that that's what he's going to knock on your door and collect. But in the case of the Moches, he's going to determine how much money he wants to collect from you. He's going to always say, well, that's the tax. But he's directly pocketing it. Now, this, okay, I don't want to get complicated here, but the Sma, that's a super commentary on Shulchan Aruch Hoshin Mishpat, he adds another element to the equation, why a Moches, Stam Moches is possible. And he says that in the case of a Moches, he is notel mi omed hadas, ubidavar she'elo kitzva. It's very similar to the Beis Yosef. He's saying that the moches has to decide with his omedas, you know, he has to evaluate in order to arrive at a certain sum that has to be collected, how much he should tax each individual. So he really works out, you know, all the details. But I think if we go back to the Beis Yosef, that's the easiest way to go, that the moches is going to, and that's what he is authorized to do, to pocket the money, but again, not more than what he's supposed to be getting. Now the Gemara tells a story. How many people in this room like stories? All right, you like stories? Now this is a story about Avua de Rabbi Zera. You know, very often in Shas, we see that a person's yichus is his son. And he's called the father of so-and-so. So for example, when I go, you know, when I go into any sort of medical circle, so, oh, Berzon, you're Baruch Berzon's father. You know, they don't even care about my name. I'm just the father of Baruch Berzon, you know, because he's the he's in charge of the emergency medicine. In any event, so here too, like for example, I don't know if you ever heard of Avua de Shmuel. We don't even know his name. We only know that he was the father of Shmuel. So here we have a story about the father of Zera. Avad Gabiyusa Tlesar Shanin. Now you and I might think that the Avua de Rabbi Zera should not be boasting about the fact that he was a tax collector, especially in the light of everything we've been saying about these tax collectors. But he, by his own admission, worked in this trade, that was his profession, for no less than 13 years. But as we'll soon see, and the story unfolds, he was working for the benefit of the Jewish community in a clandestine way. You know, sometimes you take a job and it seems on the outside that you're working against the interests of the Jewish people, but really in your heart you're doing so because you're going to do something under the surface, you know, below the surface, that's going to benefit the Jewish community. So he took it upon himself for 13 years to protect the Jewish community by being the tax collector on behalf of the king. What did he do on behalf of the Jewish community? Kiavi osi reish nahara lebasa. Now, literally, Resh Nahara means the head of the river. Every city of significance, every urban center, was on a riverbank. So the head of the city was called the head of the river. Right? It's like, for example, if you're ever in Hungary, right? You go to Budapest, right? So Budapest is really two different cities, but it's on the Danube River. So the river sort of defines that area. So he's the head of the Danube. You know, he's the head of the city. Havi Osi Reish Nahara L'Masa. Masa means a city. Osi means to come. So the Reish Nahara, the head honcho, who's the he's the officer that represents the government, he comes to town. And obviously, what he wants to do is find out how many Jews live in the town, because he's going to charge them taxes per capita. So Ki Havi Chazi Rab. Now, what's going to happen now is that the father of Rab Zera, he gets wind of the fact that the Rosh Hanahar, right, the head of the Tsar of the city, is coming to figure out how many Jews are in the city. The more Jews, the merrier, because he's going to up the ante on the tax. What do you say? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
The more the people, the more he controls.
Correct. So since he's charging a tax per head, obviously he wants the population to be higher. On the other hand, when the Sar Ha'ir, this head honcho, is going to decide, X, this is the amount of gilded that I want collected from the city, then it's best for the city, for the Jews in the city, if the population is lower. So now, the Avua de Rab Zera gets wind of the fact that the head of the city is coming to town. He's about to knock on Avua de Rab Zera's door, right? In another hour or so, he's going to get there. So Rabbi Zera wants to tip off the people of the city that now's a good time to go underground, if you know what I mean, to fly the coop, so that the total number of Jews in the city will be much lower. You know, this reminds me of, what was his name? Oof. At the time of the Boston Tea Party. What was his name, the guy with the lantern? Paul Revere. Who remembers Paul Revere? Again, I'm remembering something from 55 years ago. Paul Revere. Right? The Brits are coming, right? He ran around with the lantern, you know, to tell everybody. It's like the famous story of Rabbi Sol Salanta that they used to have a guy who would go around to wake up people for slichos. And he would wake up everybody. Now, not everybody had to get up in the middle of the night for slichos. So Rabbi Sol Salanta, he said, be very careful, you know, don't wake up everybody. Anyway, so this Avuah de Rabbi Zera is now, you know, he's notifying, he's putting everyone in the city on notice. The Sara'ir is coming to count the to take a census of the Jewish people. Now's the time to go underground. Now later on, I'm going to have a whole discussion with you about what's called Dina de Malchusa Dina. If you're familiar with that, we don't cheat the government. So the question is, why Rabbi Zera's father, who's a great tzaddik, is in a sense giving hand to cheating the government? So keep that question on the back burners. It's not that I'm ignorant of that question. Now the Gemara tells us that Avuah de Rabbi Zera had in his mind the population, the Jewish population, divided into two categories. And he would have a different approach in terms of notification to each one of these two categories. The first category are the scholars. Ki Avichazi, when he saw the Rabbanon, the scholars, like maybe he came into the Beis HaMedrash or he came into the Emek Learning Center. So Amalahu, he said to them, and he quoted a pasuk in Yeshayahu HaNavi, Lech Ami Bo Bechadorecha. Go, my nation, into your hiding inner chambers, meaning hide yourselves, because I'm going to tell the Sar HaIr that there's a small Jewish population here, and therefore he doesn't have to anticipate a great sum of tax money. So it's very important that you hide yourselves, and then we'll give a different number that really is accurate in terms of the population of the city to the Sar HaIr. But Ki Avichazi Inshi Demasa, when he saw the rank and file members of the Jewish community, not the Talmidei Chachamim, Amar Lahem, he said to them. Now, what's going to be in the next line here at the bottom of the page of Chaf Hei Amud Beis is a kind of hidden coded message. In other words, whereas to the Talmidei Chachamim, Avuah de Rabbi Zera was very explicit about it, and he said to him, go into your hiding places, into your inner chambers, so that I can get away and fool the Sara'ir that the population is lower. But when he got to the rank and file citizens, he came up with a coded message. And he said to them as follows. Now, when you give a message in a coded form, why do you do so? What are you afraid of?
Someone else.
Yeah, if the word gets out and the Sara'ir finds out that Avuah de Rabbi Zera is notifying the people of his arrival, of his imminent arrival, and therefore they should hide to fool him, the repercussions could be tremendous. I mean, at the very least, Avuah de Rabbi Zera is in deep trouble, be locked up in jail for the rest of his life. Worse than that, it could be a pogrom, chas v'shalom. And certainly he's going to up the ante on the taxes, so it's very important that the word doesn't get out. So instead of whispering it, what Rabbi Zera does is he codifies it. He hides it in a coded form. And he told them, look, Reish Nahara Asalamasa, the Sara'ir is coming to the city. Okay, that he can't get in trouble for, because obviously the Sara'ir is going to expect Rabbi Zera to get this, you know, the Jews together and collect them and take a census and find out how many Jews are in the city. But then he said to them, "Vehaidna." Now that's an important word in Aramaic for those who like to learn words in Aramaic and keep a kind of a lexicon. The word "haidna" means now. This is the right time when what's going to happen. Nachis means to slaughter. Now the word slaughtering can be taken literally, but even in modern English, in the idiomatic use of the word slaughter, when you slaughter someone, you mean or when you say I'm going to kill him, you don't mean literally you're going to kill him, but something's going to happen that's going to really have a damaging effect. Nachis Abba Lefum Bra Ubra Lefum Abba. It means that the father is going to slaughter, he says here in the Hebrew, Yishchod Es Ha'Abba Bifnei Ben, Ves Ben Bifnei Aviv, that this Sar Ha'ir is going to go on a slaughtering rampage, so to speak. But again, he said it in a coded form. And he says that he's gonna slaughter the father in the presence of his son, or the son in the presence of his father, meaning he's gonna collect taxes up to the sky, and it's gonna kill us. You know, the taxes that he has in mind are so severe that the Jewish people and this community in that particular city are gonna be in danger, because the law is that if the Jews don't pay the taxes, the repercussions are immense. So the commentaries make the following additions to this Gemara. Number one, the amount of money that's going to be collected if they take an accurate census is going to be money that is needed for chius and kium, meaning to keep the community alive and thriving. So just like a father provides, how do you say in English, parnasa, he provides sustenance for his young children, if you take away the father's money, then it's as if you are slaughtering the child. The child will not have any source of life. And in the flip case, let's say, for example, you have an elderly father, and as a son, you are supporting your father. He can't work, he has no income. Then if you take away the money from the son, then you're in effect slaughtering the father. The father's going to die of starvation. So the Ad Rabbah says, why was he, the Avur, the Rav Zeir, why was he so explicit with regard to the Talmidei Chachamim? And in the case of the rank and file citizens, he was more clandestine about it. He says, because with regard to the Talmidei Chachamim, he says that he had total trust, shelo yalshinu olav l'sar ha'ir, that they would not snitch and tell the sar ha'ir why they were encouraged to hide, to go underground. Aval l'shar anshe ha'ir chashash, he was afraid, ula yesh bahem adam, maybe this one person amongst the rank of false citizens, she'eno hagun, he's not interested in the benefit of the Jewish community or protecting the interests of the father of Rabbi Zera. He wants to get paid off by the Sarair, so he wants to be a snitcher. How do you say it in modern? They use a different word today.
Informer.
An informer. He wants to be the informer. I mean, this is the whole story during the Holocaust, you know, the capos and so forth and so on. You know, some of them really tried to alleviate the suffering of the Jews, but many were interested just in saving their own skin. That's all they were interested in. So therefore, says the Yad Ramah, Lo Amar Lahem, Avu the Rav Zeir did not express himself beferush lischabos, to tell them explicitly they should hide, El Beremez, but he alluded to them, and he says, just like in a case where there's a suspicion, there's a fear that someone is going to shech the son in the presence of his father, the father do everything to hide the son and to be very careful, and the nimshal is that they should be avoiding the sar ha'ir. Now the Yad Ramah quotes another Gemara here, and this is a whole different approach to our story of Avua de Rabbi Zera. The Gemara at the beginning of Baba Basra, in the first perek on Daf Ches, tells us that which members of the Jewish community have to pay the tax, the municipal tax to the Sarair, and which did not. And the Gemara establishes, and if you don't know this Gemara, you might be shocked by this, that Talmidei Chachamim Peturim Mimas, that the scholars, because they were dedicated to the study of Torah, the teaching of the Torah, they were dayanim, they were judges, they were sort of the clergymen of the city, and they didn't have to pay the tax. The rest of the city would cover the tax even for the Talmidei Chachamim. Lachain Amar Lahem, therefore Rabbi Zeir returns to the Talmidei Chachamim, and he says, Sheyachbiu Atzmam, they should hide themselves, Kidei Shelo Yiraem, so that no one should see them. because they're potter from the mas. They don't really have to pay the tax. And the Sara Ir, if he catches these Talmidei Chachamim, he's going to demand, extract the tax from them. Avol Shara Om, Lo Omer Lahem Lihichame, Kevan Sheim Chayovim B'mas. And therefore, the rest, the balance of the city, with the exception of Talmidei Chachamim, they actually have an obligation to pay the taxes. He's not going to tell them that they should hide and therefore evade taxes. Kimavur b'mesechta nedarim. The Gemara Nedarim Daf Chav Ches establishes that anyone who has to pay the governmental tax is not allowed to avoid the taxes. V'lachein amar lehem, what does he, Avud Reb Zera, say to the rank and file citizen of the city? Shesar ha'ir yikbe me'a avos al habonim. V'ayinu shekevet shel talmidei chachamim nechbo'im yitol mikrovoseim avuram v'tzrichim heim lihizoyer. He says the following, that he told the other members of the city, the non-Talmidei Chachamim, that what's going to happen is that the Sara Ir, if he finds out that the Talmidei Chachamim are hiding, he's going to look for relatives of theirs, and he's going to collect extra taxes from their relatives to make up for the Talmidei Chachamim. So he warned them to be careful of the Sara Ir, because they may end up paying more than what they have to pay. Now, I asked you the initial question, how could it be that Rabbi Zera is telling people, whether it's the Talmidei Chachamim, and according to the first interpretation, even the members of the city, although there he was more secretive about it, that they should hide themselves. We have a principle in the Gemara in Gittin and other places in Shas and Nedarim called Dina de Malchusa Dina. Have you heard of it? That we have to oblige the law of the land. We're not allowed to steal from the government. For example, if we go on certain roads and they are taxed, we have to pay the taxes. So how could Avuah Rabbi Zera boast about his position for 13 years that whenever the Sarayir came, he told the people to hide away so that they should be cheating on their taxes? Says the Meiri that Dina Malchusa Dina only applies when the actual sum of money was determined. From that moment on, kishenikba haschum shel amas, when the determination has already been made and the tax has been set, then the city and all its members have to come up with those taxes. That's called dina de malchusa dina. However, there's no Dina de Malchusa Dina before the tax has been set. Why? Because at this point, legally, no one is obligated in the taxes. V'muta l'shanos b'dvarim ulemayit b'mispar ha'noshim k'dei sheyigbe pochos min amas. So that if it's a matter of determination of how much the mas is here, since that determination has not yet been made, there's no law of Dina de Malchusa Dina. Now, I don't have time to do this with you, but there's a book called Dina de Malchusa Dina. It's about 600 pages long in modern Hebrew, and it won what's called in Israel a kind of a Nobel Prize in literature called Pras HaRav Kook. It's a very prestigious prize that's given to people who make a tremendous contribution to Jewish knowledge. And this area of Dina de Malchusa Dina is very complicated. There are innuendos, ins and outs. I mean, just to throw out one idea, the Ran Shita is that Dina de Malchusa Dina applies vis-a-vis a non-Jewish government, but it doesn't apply to a Jewish government unless that Jewish government has a status of Malchus B'Yisrael. So Dafka here in Israel, according to the Ran, you'd be allowed to cheat the government. That's, again, I'm just throwing out, just to give you a flavor of how complicated this principle of Dina de Malchusa Dina is. Under what circumstances does it apply? According to some, if the government is overcharging because the government wants to be opulent, or because the government wants to take advantage of the Jewish people, and they're going to charge the Jews more than they charge the Goyim, that's not a fair law, and there's no Dina de Malchusa Dina. According to other poskim, if the Jewish community is going through very difficult financial straits, and paying the taxes would literally, you know, push them over the ledge, and it would just destroy the financial backbone of the Jewish community, then Dina Malchusa Dina doesn't apply. So again, there are all sorts of rules and regulations. By the way, if anyone wants to go online and track down this book, again, the words Dina Malchusa Dina are not going to do it for you, just write Shmuel Shiloh. Okay, he was the author, may rest in peace, was the author of that book, and he won Prosser of Cook. I have a signed copy of that book from the author because his mother and my mother were sisters. Okay. Now we go on to Daf Chavav Amud Aleph. It's about time we got to Daf Chavav. Ubiganzu Kuli Alma. What happened is that as a result of Rabbi Zera, Paul Revere, they got the message and everybody hid. And when the Sarair came, Kiasi, Amale, he said to the father of Zera, Miman mi boy, from whom am I going to demand taxes? You know, there are very few people living in the city, and he reduced the cat taxes. So basically, what the Avud Rabbi Zera accomplished was, he saved the city. And now we begin to understand why he boasts the fact that he was the tax collector for the last 13 years. Now the Gemara wants to give another postscript to this story to tell you exactly how honest of a person Avuah the Rabbi Zera was, because again, every tax collector is a little bit suspect of pocketing some extra funds. Ki nicha nafshe, when the father of Zera was on his deathbed, so nafshe means his life, nicha is going away, his life is ebbing away. Omalahu, he told the members of his household, shkolu means to take tlesar mo'e, 13 mo'os, this is a significant amount of money, ditzrorili besidinai, tzrorili means I wrapped him up besadin, sadin is a cloth, like a turban, and that's where I hid it. So he told them exactly where they could find these 13 golden coins. V'hadrulei l'planya, and make sure that you return them to so and so. Why? This is his last will and testament on his deathbed. He's such an honest person. D'shaklitinu minei, I took it from him as a tax collector collects his taxes. Velo it's tarichule, and at the end I didn't need that money. So that money was being held by me, and I never got a chance to return it to its proper owner. Now the Yad Ramah wants to understand what's going on over here. Rabbi Zera was not Avuah Rabbi Zera was not suspect of taking extra money. How did he end up with 13 gold coins that belonged to someone that he collected apparently as a tax collector? And he didn't need it. Meaning it wasn't taxable money, and now he has to return it. So the Yad Ramah, in his very creative mind, he weaves a whole story here, and he says the following: that on one particular occasion, apparently the Sar HaIr came, and he set a certain sum that had to be collected from the city. And what happened was that one person, for some reason, was not available, and the Avuah the Rabbi Zera did not get a chance to collect that money from him. However, the Sar HaIr counted the money that he received from Avuah the Rabbi Zera, and there were 13 gold coins missing. And he got upset, and he said, wait a minute, there must be some Jew over here who avoided paying his taxes. And Avuah the Rabbi Zera realized that it must have been this fellow that he didn't collect his taxes. So he immediately ran to the guy and collected that money. By the time he got back to the Sar HaIr with the 13 gilden, the Sar HaIr had already moved on to the next city, and he never actually came back to collect those 13 coins. So therefore, Avuah Rabbi Zera had to return those 13 coins to that person from whom he had collected, but that money was never collected by the government. But you see how honest of a person he was. He could have easily said that I'll pocket the 13 gilded, because after all, you know, the person who gave him the money rightfully had to give him the money because he was paying his taxes as he's legally obligated to do so. and he wouldn't have any clue that the Sarah Ir had moved on to his next place, and that Rabbi Avuda Rav Zera was holding on to the money. But the Avuda Rav Zera had it in a special place. You can imagine he locked it up. This is not the Yad Raman, this is Berzon talking. Maybe he locked it up in a safe, and maybe he put it out of his mind, or maybe he just didn't get a chance, and he took ill, and on his deathbed, the first thing that was on his mind, you can imagine he had plenty of things to tell his family at that moment, but he made sure to tell them exactly where the money was hidden, and how the money has to be returned. Halavai Rabosai, that we should have tax collectors like Avuda Rav Zera. And then we would never have to passel a tax collector for Avis. You know, it's very interesting to me that very often we take money and we lock it up somewhere and we just sort of forget about it. I don't know if you've ever had this experience that you're doing Pesach cleaning and all of a sudden you find an envelope and you're like dancing for joy. But the question is, why did you put that money away? Now, if you put it away for a rainy day, it's your money, that's one thing. But sometimes you put away money because you owe it to somebody. So it's very important for a person to be careful, you know, and make sure that he knows exactly, even when he hides money away, what that money is designated for, is earmarked for. Some people put away money in a safe deposit because they want to give tzedakah. I don't know how many of you are makpid on Maisik Sof. I'm not saying you have to be makpid, but if you've taken upon yourself that minog to give 10% of your income, then very often what you'll do is you'll designate some funds for Maisik Sof, but at this particular moment in time you don't have any aniyim to give it to, and you place it in some, you know, it's, you hide it under some turban. In other situations, I'll tell you, people lock up money in a safe, and even though it's tzedakah money, because they just can't get themselves to give the tzedakah. It's very hard, you know, to part with your money. You know, in English we use the word stingy. You know, people who, in Yiddish it's called karg, you know, they just can't, you know, you appeal to them for a cause, and boom, you know, they, if you're lucky, if they give you a couple of shekels. And the reason for that is very difficult for a person, you know, especially if it's hard-earned money, you know, to part with his money. So before I start the next Gemara, I just wanted to tell you a story that my father told me that always made an impact on me. I don't know if it'll make an impact on you. Here in Yerushalayim, about, let's say, 120 years ago, the Rav of Yerushalayim, his name is Rav Shmuel Salant. He came from the city of Salant, not related to the founder of the Muslim movement. Reb Shmuel was a great, giant leader. Everybody looked up to him. And at that time in Jerusalem, people were literally dying of starvation. I mean, the poverty was beyond belief. And this continued into the 20s and the 30s and the 20th century. The people turned to Reb Shmuel, to the Rav of the city, and they said, "We're desperate. You must come up with some funds for us, or we're going to just perish." So Reb Shmuel said that I've tried to collect money, and this is the amount of money I collected. I couldn't get more. So they said, "But what about Yankel Beryl?" I'm just making up a name. Nobody to this day knows his name, but there was a certain individual, and he was quote unquote a wealthy guy. Now, what wealthy meant, you know, in Jerusalem in the year 1900, thus basically, I'm sure he wasn't, you know, anywhere in the President of the United States' category, if you know what I mean. But apparently he had a couple of bucks. So Reb Shmuel told the people that on many occasions when we had a public magbit, you know, a collection, I tried to get him to give money, but I was not successful in doing so. It's a waste of time to visit him. The people came back to him 3 or 4 days later and they said, "Reb Shmuel, we have no choice. Everything depends upon this one individual. He's the only one who could save us." So if that be the case, the Rav said, "I know I'm wasting my time, but I'm going to go and I'm going to bang on his door and see what happens." The man was so impressed that Reb Shmuel himself, the Rav of Yerushalayim, came to visit him. He sat him down. They drank a glezel of tea, and Reb Shmuel poured out his heart, and he told him what the situation here in Jerusalem is. The man broke down. He picks up his keys and he throws them at Reb Shmuel, and he says to him, Rebbe, I cannot do it, but here are the keys. Go into the safe and take the money that you need. And I was so impressed by this story. I'll tell you why. Because what it really means is that stinginess is a disease. It's literally a psychological ailment. You know, people suffer from, everybody has their phobias and their diseases. You know, otherwise the, you know, the shrinks would have no business. So we got to give them some parnasa too. But imagine the man finally broke down. You know, he reached his heart, but he couldn't give him the money. He just couldn't do the action of going into the safe and giving him the money. Amar Rav Shimon. Yeah, what do you say, Steve?
No, just the story they told us in Opan, the rich man, he falls into a swimming pool, he doesn't know how to swim, and they keep telling him, you know, give me your hand. He says, I don't give anything to anybody. Yeah, and the wise guy comes to him and says, take my hand. And he says,
if it's take my hand, that's right. It. Rabosa, I would ask you as a favor to me to please, whatever you need from this room, take out before the shiur.
Okay.
It really, you know, if you take a look at the people in the room, it really distracts me, okay?
Sorry.
Yeah, so just if you don't mind making it, you know, in advance, just take it out before. Okay. So just as an introduction to tomorrow's sugya, Amar Rabbi Shimon, we're now getting into the laws of Shvius of Shemitah. Every 7 years in the cycle, the Shemitah and the fruits have to be given, or they have to, you know, you can't lock up your field, you have to allow the aniyim to take from the field. And we had something called Osvei Shvius, people who would collect Shvius. Now what does that mean, people who collect Shvius? We're not talking about, you know, thieves. We're not, you know, who are these people collecting shvius? And in a general sense, who are the people collecting shvius? They are the poor people, correct? So what's the big deal? Rabbi Shimon says, "Betchila hayu korin osan." These people that which are going to be added to the list of psulim are the people who violate Shvius. They are people who do merchandise with Shvius. But at the beginning, the first stage, they weren't doing merchandise with Shvius. So what were they? They were Osvei Shvius. So what's wrong with being Osvei Shvius? If they were Shvius collectors, they were poor people who came into the field to collect their Shvius, that's what's coming to them. So the Yad Rav Mah here makes the following comment. He says that the law of Shvius is that a poor person is allowed to take exactly what he needs for himself and his family during the course of the year. What happened was that the Aniyim, when they had this opportunity to collect Shvius, they exaggerated a little bit. They were Osvei Shvius and they took more than what they needed. The hope would be that if they had extra, you know, extra amounts of produce, which they didn't need, they would be able to sell it on the market and make a little profit to support their family. So instead of taking exactly the food that they needed for their family, they would take some extra and sell the increment, sell the difference. But yet, they weren't professional sochrei shvius. So at this point in history, we did not add... The Chachamim did not add a special category of psul that would apply to Osvei Shvius. Later on, at some historical moment, the situation really deteriorated as far as the observance of Shvius, and we got to the point called Sochrim of Shvius. Not Osvei Shvius, these were not the Aniyim who collected the Shvius, but rather these were people who were doing business with Shvius. And the Torah says that the peros of Shvius are li'achla, meant to be eaten, below l'schara, but you're not allowed to do merchandise and make a living from selling on the market Shvius, peros Shvius. That's the Kedusha of Shvius. So at this point in time, when we really had an outright violation of the laws of Shvius, they were now sochrei Shvius, then the Rabbanan got up, and they enacted a new psul for this misdemeanor, this misbehavior of violating the Torah law of Shvius called Sochrei Shvius. Now, who were the Sochrei Shvius? So you and I would say that the Sochei Shvius were the landowners, the field owners, who would collect, harvest and collect the produce during the seventh year and sell it on the market. Well, then we don't understand Rabbi Shimon, because Rabbi Shimon isolates a group and he says about that group that mitchila hayu korin oson osvei shvius, that initially they were called osvei shvius, and then chazru lekrosom sochrei shvius, that same group was made up of X number of individuals. Those individuals were originally osvei shvius, now they became sochrei shvius. Well, what do you mean? If you're talking about sochrei shvius meaning the owners of the field, the landowners, the field owners are selling shvius, that's a whole different group. So you can't say me that initially we call them osvei shvius, the osvei shvius are the aniyim, who, as we said before, exaggerated and took a surplus, which wasn't necessary. And then the sochrei shvius are the field owners, because then you're talking about two different people, and it says hayu korin also, that we call them by two different names. Initially we called it by the name of osvei shvius, and eventually we changed their name at a certain point in time and we called them sochrei shvius. What exactly is going on? Maika Omar, the whole statement of Rabbi Shimon, which is codified in our Mishnah, makes no sense. So we're going to see Rabbi Yehuda tomorrow, so I just want to show you the Mishnah so you know what we're going to be talking about. Let's go back to the Mishnah, which is on Daf, what is it, Chav Dalet Amud Beis. And it says, Elu Hein Hapsulim. So we have Mesachim Bekuvia, Mavel Beribis, Mafriche Yonim, and then we have Sochrei Shvius, Amar Rabbi Shimon. Mitchila, and in the original point in history, Hayu Korin Osan Chacham called them Osvei Shvius. And at that point they were Kosher Liedus. But Misharavu Anosim, and we don't know what that phrase means, but something changed historically. Chazru Lekrosom, they changed the name, they called them Sochrei Shvius. And we saw already in the Reisha of the Mishnah that Sochrei Shvius are Apostle Liedus. So at what point did the Chachamim institute this new category, the fourth category of Psul Eidus called Sochrei Shvius? It's at the point in which they changed their name. They changed them from calling him Osvei Shvius and they called him Sochrei Shvius. What is the meaning of those two names, and why did the Rabbanan at some moment in time decide that they would institute and enact a new category of disqualified Eidim, which are called Sochrei Shvius? So thanks to everyone for joining me today, and Avirtz Hashem, tomorrow we'll try to figure out this Reb Shimon, which is very enigmatic. If anybody wants to join me for a little bit of an Iyun Shir at the beginning of Brachos, which is good for those who are learning Daf Yomi, so please stick around. We'll start in about 2 minutes.